Blog Talk Radio.
To inform, inspire, and empower Alcoholics Anonymous sponsorship, locally and internationally, to be their very best, both personally and spiritually. This is the mission of rumradio.org, an internet radio program dedicated to carrying the message of recovery to a world plagued by alcoholism and addiction. Alcoholism and addiction is the number one health issue in our world today, and rumradio.org is actively participating in the solution. Interviews with a plethora of people sharing their experience, strength, and hope. Live Sundays at 9 p.m. Central Time and rewound again on Saturday and Monday. Tune in to 12-Stepology at its best on rumradio.org.
And the crowd went narcoleptic. Welcome and hello. This is Joseph G. with Rum Radio and rumradio.org, the most comprehensive 12-step sponsorship in the known and the unknown universe. The unknown universe might have just recently gotten a little smaller. The General Service Organization, known as the GSO, not the KGB, but the GSO, which is headquarters to Alcoholics Anonymous in the ivory towers of New York City, through the auspices of The Grapevine, which is our monthly magazine, we call that our meetings in print, have produced a book. And they produced other books before, but this is the first book they've ever produced in 78 years on sponsorship. It's called One-on-One Sponsorship, $10.99. You go to the Grapevine website. I'm sure it'll be in the bookstores pretty soon. $10.99, shipping and handling, license and tax, $17.24. I understand it's a hefty work. This is exciting news for Rum Radio. This is the first time the governing body has put together this kind of information to disseminate to the world of recovery on sponsorship, and we couldn't be more excited. Of course, we don't know for sure the quality of the information. We assume is going to be good, but I don't want to have acceptance until I have inspection. So I'm excited to see it. I'm sure there's going to be a lot of good stories on there and a lot of tools, and the Grapevine needs the money. There's no doubt about it. They've been struggling for quite a while now. So by buying the book, not only are you helping your own sponsorship efforts, you're supporting the Grapevine and the GSO by purchasing this. And I think I see a game changer in the offing. And now we have an Avis to our hearts and a Macy's to our gimbal. So we've gotten validation on the website. So I'm really excited about that too. I'd like to acknowledge WNAH, that's Hoyt Carter and Tony the Horse, who affords us the opportunity to broadcast live to their listening audiences in Nashville, parts of Kentucky, and Alabama. And they do this as a public service presentation. They believe in the work that we're trying to accomplish. We also like to acknowledge RecoveryToday.net magazine. It's one of the finer recovery journals, and they afford us some print space from time to time. I gratefully like to introduce my co-host, Harold B. He's a family intervention specialist. He does a fine work with troubled families, and I personally believe as the families are the basic unit of our society. And as the family goes, so does the country, so does the nation, so does the world. Most of the people in prisons today are drug and alcohol related. The children have grown up without correct principles through the mean streets, like weeds and an empty lot. And, of course, they learn from what the other people know and not from home. Latchkey kids, we used to call them. These are the folks in the prisons. Drugs and alcohol have become their parents. So here at Rum Radio, what we're trying to do is trying to get the message out that there is hope. There is a relief from this disease of mind, body, and spirit. But there's certain things you have to do. Now, all this is really good information, but information is void in a vacuum. You have to take action. I believe we're saved by grace after all that we can do, that after all that we can talk, that after all that we can think, not even after all that we can pray. The magic words in AA is action and more action, for faith without works is dead. By the way, this is not AA. This is not Alcoholics Anonymous. This is not NA, Narcotics Anonymous. It's not CA, Cocaine Anonymous. We're closer to Paranoids Anonymous. That's the group that nobody will tell you where they hold the meetings, and it's really hard to find. So we're kind of hard to find sometimes. But we're here, and we plan to stay here, at least for the next hour. So stay with us. Harold, tell us about what you're doing in the prisons.
Yes, I'm delighted to be here. Thank you for the nice introduction, and I look forward to tonight's conversation with our interviewee. That'll be great. I go into the prisons every Monday night, Fort Bend County Jail, and I carry the recovery message. The one that I'm most excited about right now is called Celebrate Recovery. It's like AA with Jesus Christ at the middle and all the scriptures added back to the steps the way it was in 1939. We are well received there. I've got a team of men and a team of women that go in, and the people are very grateful for the effort that we're making to do that. And recently I've had quite an increase in people with sex addiction in my practice. I'm a family therapist and addictions counselor. And I've come to find out that, of course, 50% of marriages end in divorce. 50% of the divorces there is some porn addiction or sex addiction involved in those. That is a lot of addiction, a lot of recovery. The Sex Addicts Anonymous meetings are growing and growing, and they are really keen on sponsorship also. It's really heartwarming to see. And so the enemy is using lots of different tricks and techniques to make people's lives miserable and then end their lives. And the enemy likes to take the family down with the addict. So that's the spiritual warfare I'm fighting, and there's a lot of people recovering, not everyone, of course, but we plant the seeds and then God makes them grow. So thank you, Joseph.
You're welcome, Harold. They were talking at church today about about misery, and I raised my hand and I said, you know, everybody thinks that misery loves company. That's not altogether true. Misery demands company.
Yeah.
When somebody's miserable, they're demanding some company. Let me clue you. I like to start off the show with a third step prayer. And the way I introduce this to my new sponsees, usually they get their beginner's chip, and we use that. These are recycled aluminum beer can tops. No, they're just it's aluminum disc in some places. It's called a beginner's chip or a desire chip, and that's an outward sign of an inward commitment to try our way of life for 24 hours. Is there any takers? So you come up and you get your chip. You finally made a decision that you're going to do something. Like Dr. Bob said, I'm going to go through with it. And this is the point, that point where you're going to address your problem. And they come up, and usually we have a prayer in the beginning and we have a prayer at the end of the meetings. It's like an invocation and then a benediction. And I usually I'll go around and hold hands with the prospect. And the big book says, I believe on 93, go find the prospect and start working on them. So I go find my prospect, and after the prayer, I turn around to him and I go, have you had enough? he's had enough, he usually knows exactly what I'm talking about. But he might say, what do you mean? Have you had enough humiliation? Have you had enough pain? Have you had enough time in jail? Have you had enough car accidents? Have you had enough alcohol? Have you had enough? Yes or no? Yes. Are you willing to go to any length to achieve sobriety? Yes or no? Yes. Then I tell them, you can get well from this disease of mind, body, and spirit, but there's certain things you have to do. And I carry around Clancy Eyes 7 questions. They're on the website underneath the sponsorship tab, how to find a sponsee. And you scroll down and you can send words or you can print out the 7 questions. Now, this is how I do it. The big book says you sit down with the guy and you talk to him. But I figured once he's received his beginner's chip, he's already made a decision that he's looking for a solution to his problem. The big book is really addressing the fact that the person has not come to that decision as of yet. If you read the big book on chapter 7, they're going out to people and they're trying to convince them, they're selling a prospect, they're trying to qualify that prospect that they can get well. So the conversation is in that line. Now, they've already gotten the chip now, which they really didn't do. It's a different way of doing business because they didn't do it like that back then. They went out into the hospitals, they went out to Skid Row, and they talked to these folks to try to encourage them to come in. So he's already there. It's really a godsend that they come through the doors. They're clean. They usually have cell phones, some of them, unless it's a 24-hour club. They might have a car, a place to live. I mean, these guys are golden. They're ready to go. And if I get those affirmative answers, I give them Clancy 7 questions and say, okay, first thing I need you to do is answer these 7 questions, and I need them back tomorrow. Here's my number. I expect your call. That's it. So one of two things will happen. He will do the work. He will take a simple instruction, and he will follow through showing me he is willing to go to any length. And the next day he either calls me or we get together and we go over the answers. Doesn't really matter much. It's a nice way to hit the ground running. Doesn't matter how he answers them because it's thoughtful to him, but he's demonstrated those. And then first assignment I give him is to get a home group. And the home group is where you go regularly to your recovery meetings. And then this is like your family or your lifeline group, and I need you to get 20 or 30 names, if possible, of men. I believe men with men and women with women because we relate better to the same gender. And sponsorship is a fairly intimate relationship which could be easily misconstrued with the opposite sex. We have enough hoops to go in. Let's skip this one. If you can't find the same gender, you know what? You work the steps. You could always change the sponsor if it's not working out. The key is you work the steps. And so now I got the questions back, and he's got a home group. He's got the names of the men, and every day for the next 30 days, I want you to call a different man on that list. And the nice thing about the list is if he's out of town and he can't reach a sponsor, you know, everybody's got cell phones, but nobody ever answers them. And chances are he's not going to be able to reach me, but he could reach one of those guys on the list when he needed to talk to somebody. A sponsor cannot tell him very much more than anybody else in the program can, as far as at least initially, my experience. So you call somebody, you could talk to him, get him to a meeting, whatever. So he's got a lifeline now, and asked permission if he could recite the third step prayer. And the third step prayer is found on page 63 of the basic text of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I like to use the Big Book because it's the template of all 12-step recovery. Any 12-step recovery group, it came from the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I like to use the basic text because it's the original format, and that's probably the cleanest way of doing 12-step recovery. And the prayer goes like this. Now he's going to ask these guys, and the reason why I have him do that, by the way, is first it's getting him used to picking up the 500-pound telephone and asking for help. That's hard for a lot of folks. Secondly, it connects him up in his home group. They get to know his name, and he gets to know their name. Thirdly, the third step prayer is also called a surrender prayer. It's going to encapsulate what we're going to try to accomplish by working all 12 steps. It's a spiritual program. And fourthly, the person he's calling might have been thinking about taking his first drink, first hit of crack, first shot of dope. Chances are he will not. So it enlivens both him and the person he's calling. So your sponsor is already into service work, which we find is the key that creates the lock of our long-term sobriety. And this is the third step prayer. God, I offer myself to thee, to build with me and do with me as thy wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help, of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. Can I get an amen on that?
Amen.
Well, I'd like to introduce our interview. This is going to be really interesting and quite exciting, I believe. Jay, goes by J.S. Now, this isn't Jay from Men in Black. This isn't the Men in Black Jay. This is a different Jay. And she's going to tell us her story, what it was like, what happened, what it's like now, and what her passion is that keeps her in maximum service to God and her fellows. Always great stories. Folks, let me tell you, we interview miracles. And how do you weigh a miracle? What does a yardstick for a miracle look like? I've never seen one. It's just a miracle. So, Jay, tell us, how you doing tonight, and what was it like?
Well, it's great to be here, and thank you so much for inviting me to your show and giving me the opportunity to share my experience, strength, and hope with others. First of all, I'd like to say that I'm very nervous sharing my story, and I thought about it ever since you asked me today, or I panicked, actually. And then I prayed, and I asked God to help me find the right words to share with you and your audience. So whatever is coming out of my mouth is just, that's God, really. And it's none of my, I didn't think about it before or write it down. So, you know, you're going to get the pure version. So,
oh, good.
Yeah. So, you know, what it was like and what happened and what it's like now. And, you know, I grew up in a pretty normal home. My mom worked for the government. My dad worked for government. My parents split up when I was pretty young because of my father's alcoholism. It would be later on that I would actually form a bond and relationship with him after he got sober, and he would tell me about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I'm very grateful for him sharing that with me. And, addiction and alcoholism runs in families, but recovery runs in families too. And I'm so glad that it runs in mine. I lived in a, just a normal neighborhood, a regular suburban neighborhood. And even though my parents split up when I was young, there wasn't a whole lot of drama in my house when I was young. My mother wasn't an alcoholic, but she loved exciting people and exciting relationships. So my stepfather also worked at the same government job. And he didn't have an alcohol addiction, but he did have a sex addiction and a shopping addiction, always running up the bills and always needed to buy something new in order to fix whatever it was, you know. And he's a wonderful man, and we also have a good relationship today. But anyway, so I grew up in that house, and it was pretty uneventful. I mean, I just we were involved in scouting and sports, and back then you'd ride your bike for hours on a sunny afternoon, and didn't have all the worries that you have now as a parent. I mean, I have three children, and my sons are 24, 26. My daughter is 13, almost 14, and I don't think that she goes anywhere without me at all. I can't imagine even letting her ride her bike anywhere, and that's kind of a sad statement, but that's just the way things are today.
Things have changed a lot, haven't they?
Things have changed. They've changed quite a bit. I took my first drink around the age of eight, and I remember my first drink. I think everybody remembers their first drink, you know, with some sort of fondness. At least a lot of the alcoholics I know do, right?
Yes.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah,
yeah,
that was.
Yeah. We were having Thanksgiving dinner, and I was helping clean up. I went around the table, and I emptied everybody's glasses of wine, and I got tipsy, and my I could feel my face get warm, and it just kind of spread through my body, through the tips of my toes, and it was just the most wonderful, amazing feeling. And I just felt free.
I can relate to that.
I just felt free. Yeah, I just felt free. And, you know, later on I could reflect upon that, and, well, why did I feel the need, you know, to feel different? I think a lot of kids feel like that feeling of feeling different. Even kids that are, you know, that don't grow up to be alcoholics and addicts, they'll spin around on the merry-go-round really, really fast, get dizzy, fall down. It's fun, you know. But the difference between me and, a normie is that, I spin around, hit my head, it hurts, and I keep doing it over and over again. And a normie will stop, and I keep going. And that's just the way it always was. I loved to babysit when I got my Girl Scout certification and my CPR to babysit for all of the neighbors. I've always been very enterprising, so my mom helped me make flyers, and I went and I put them in everybody's doors, and I started babysitting for all the neighborhood children. Oh, you know, we're going to invite this responsible Girl Scout over to, you know, to watch our kids in the evening while we're away, and they didn't know that I was draining their liquor cabinets. You know?
Great cover.
Yeah. You know, and then later on in junior high, I was the Girl Scout in full uniform with, you know, joints in my backpack. So, you know, it just kind of grew from there. I was never really into drugs. Drugs weren't for me. I really didn't even know how to inhale. You know, I had just, you know, we found this stuff in my friend's garage, and because her mom grew pot, like a lot of people just grew some pot out in their backyard in the 70s or something. You know, there seemed to be a lot of it in my neighborhood, in my regular, you know, white bread suburban neighborhood. And, you know, we just knew that it was, you know, it was dried out. It was in a can. And if we rolled these things up in these little papers, you know, we could sell them at school and make money. So I always had the, you know, the spirit, this entrepreneurial spirit, right? Which would serve me well later on when the economy went sideways, and we'll get to that story eventually.
Yeah, spread to Colorado.
Oh, well, what did you say about Colorado? I only heard a piece of it because of our connection.
The entrepreneurial spirit has spread to Colorado. And
yes,
Washington
State,
yeah.
Well, it's kind of like, you know, they made this argument that, oh, gosh, if you legalize marijuana here, you know, everybody will start smoking it. You know, we'll have stoners everywhere. And I just think that, you know, if you're a beer person, you'll always stick with beer. If you're a vodka person like me, you're always going to like vodka. I didn't run down and get a cannabis card, and, you know, I won't be smoking pot anytime soon. But, not for me.
It was the opposite. Yeah, poster child.
The couple of times that I did try it, and later on in high school, and I was actually able to hold it in without, you know, coughing my guts out. You know, we laughed a lot and consumed half the contents of, you know, my friend's mother's pantry, and then, you know, and just watched MTV, and, you know, I think I fell asleep. It was pretty uneventful, you know. But
you had a cover as a Girl Scout. That was your first costume.
Yeah, that was my first costume. I was a Girl Scout, and I was very responsible, very responsible. So you should trust me. And you know, and I was very outgoing and really bubbly, and I could talk to anybody, you know. And you know, I think from a very early age, I liked being somebody else. And I don't know why, you know, later on I would figure out why, but back then I didn't know, you know. I was active in drama club, I was singing in the choir. I loved, you know, drama club when I was in high school. I loved being able to play another role and step into another character. That was just, it seemed to suit me perfectly and my personality. And I was friends with all of the different kids in high school, you know, all the different groups. I could hang out with any group because I was a chameleon. I'll change into whatever you need me to be in order so that you will like me. That was always a key part of my personality, was being a people pleaser and this extreme need for people to like me. So, you know, if giving you, you know, one of my favorite records would make you be my friend, you know, if giving you money or whatever it was that you needed in order so you would be friends with me, you know, I would do that. And that turned out to be really dangerous behavior in high school. I had two groups of friends when I got to high school. By this time, I dropped out of the Girl Scouts because when, you know, I'd wear my uniform to school, the bullies at school, you know, hey, they're so-and-so, let's kick her ass, you know, and they'd chase me and stuff. And, you know, and so it wasn't cool to be a Girl Scout anymore. So I left the Girl Scouts. And in high school, you know, I gravitated, of course, you know, towards the interesting people, towards the party crowd. And, you know, I was active in sports and student government. And I was also active in my church youth group. And, you know, thank goodness for my church youth group because I think they helped me, you know, from ending up in a gutter, you know. I had these two groups of friends, you know, and my church youth group friends would even do the same things that I was doing because by this time I'm already starting to get into a little bit of trouble, and so my mother has gotten concerned and she's put me into a parochial school. Because she puts me in a parochial school, all the kids are good there, right? None
of
those kids party. Oh, boy, you know, they just do it with a smile. And then, you know, we would do all the stuff on Friday and Saturday night, and then we'd be in church on Sunday and you know, and asking for forgiveness, you know. And it was a terrible struggle for me because I really didn't have my first boyfriend until, like, late in high school, like 17. And he had just come back from Europe, and he was in the military. And my parents just loved him because, you know, he was just squeaky clean, all-American, and he loved, you know, going to church with me, too. And it was just a terrible thing for us, you know, this struggle, you know, when you're teenagers and you have all these hormones going on. Well, I was a teenager. He was 21, you know, but...
How old were you?
Be together. I was 17. I was 17 and
oh,
I was 21.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I think differently about that now, you know, but back then we didn't think about it. I grew up in a town, Sacramento, California, was at the time surrounded by three active military bases. So all of the girls that I knew dated military guys, young military GIs, because they had money, they had cars. Guys in high school, you know, they had maybe a job at McDonald's and, you know, a beat-up Pinto, you know, so it was different, you know. And plus the drinking age on the military bases then was 18. So that's where all the best parties were, you know. If you wanted to date a regular high school boy, you had to wait for his parents to go out of town. But in order to have some real fun, you just go to one of the local military bases and it was Party City, so... I don't know. I like my mother, you know, I love exciting guys, you know, that love danger and love excitement. And I just always gravitated towards the military guys. So I was married and I was living on a military base by the time I was 18, right out of high school.
Wow.
And I had a regular full-time job and I'd had my first child by before my 19th birthday. And I wanted to be a grown-up. I really wanted to be a grown-up. And a couple of years later, I just felt overwhelmed, and I wanted to go home to mommy. But it was too late, you know. Before my 21st birthday, I had two little boys and a full-time job, and I was married to another alcoholic, and I didn't even know it. I didn't even know I was an alcoholic myself. I had no coping skills, no ability to do bills or to do anything. I had no ability to live life, you know, clean, sober, have any problem-solving skills. I just really had no business being married and being that young, you know. But there I was, and there was no going home. So, you know, we would just build up resentments in our arsenal, and then we would drink at each other. And in the midst of all that, we had two little kids. And
wow, you had lost a major part of your childhood.
Well, I gave it up willingly. You know,
yes.
I thought, you know, my best friend that was also, you know, in my church church youth group to back up a little bit. You know, she was my party buddy. She was my prayer buddy. She was everything to me. She was like a sister to me. And we were actually getting ready. She had invited me to spend the night at her house, and we were going to go to church in the morning. And I really, and my boyfriend, who was my fiancé at the time, wanted me to spend the night out at the base and go to a party. And she said, "You guys are going to get married. You'll be together for the rest of your lives. You know, come on, you know, let's go to the county fair tonight. We're going to go to the county fair. You know, we're going to spend the night at my house. We're going to go to church in the morning." And, you know, I went back and forth between both of them, you know, because they both wanted my time. And I ended up choosing the man that I would marry. And then the next morning on the way to church, she was driving down this little country road, and the heat was rising off the road, and there was another car that was coming towards her, and they swerved around some bicyclists, and she was hit head-on and killed instantly.
Oh,
and her, in her little Toyota Corolla, if I would have been in that little Toyota Corolla, I would have been gone too. But it wasn't my time it wasn't my time to go. You know, I was supposed to make the choice, and I made the choice to be with, you know, who would be the father of my children. I didn't know it at that time, and live. You know, but that had an incredible impact upon my life because I'd never experienced death before. I'd never been to a funeral. People in my family have a history of longevity. I'd never been to a funeral in my life, and one day I was with my best friend, and the next day she was gone. And
wow.
It was a closed casket. You know, it was like I didn't even believe she was gone. I would call her phone number just to listen to her answering machine and to hear her voice. You know, it didn't sink in. It took me a few years just to go to her grave, even though I went to the funeral, you know. But, you know, I really think that, you know, the people that graduate, I guess I should say, you know, graduate this classroom, they're right on the other side, you know, and they're cheering for us, you know, they're rooting for us, you know. If we're clean and sober, we can listen to God and we can listen for good direction. But anyway, so I was married very young. You know, we worked hard and we drank hard. You know, that was just the military culture. And we were with a bunch of other young families that all lived the same way. People smoked in their houses. I can't imagine smoking in my house, you know, let alone smoking at all, you know, but smoking in my house. But we all lived in base housing, and, you know, everybody smoked. It was crazy. You know, we could drink hard and then get up and go to work. And work all day and come home, and I'd start making cocktails while I was making dinner, and you know, we'd be passed out by 10 o'clock, get up at dark 30 and do it all over again. Oh, my gosh, I can't even imagine. And raising two kids, you know, working full time. And, you know, so that marriage actually lasted a pretty long time. But towards the end of my 20s, we were just growing apart, and his father passed away, and I left. In a pretty short amount of time. And, you know, I don't know if, you know, it was a lot of things. We didn't know how to communicate. So his way of acting out was to get drunk, and he had this terrible affliction. Whenever he would drink too much, his zipper would fall down. And it would happen a lot when I wasn't around. people that I knew and in his squadron people that I knew personally. And it was just terribly embarrassing, you know, to go to NCO Wives Club meetings and you walk in and everybody stops chattering. And when I left, I didn't leave because I didn't love him anymore. I left because I was just ashamed. And also I thought it was all about me. I didn't know why, you know. Yeah, you know, I make just as much as you do. You know, I keep the house clean. You know, I look fabulous. You know, why did you go bang that skank? You know, I didn't get that. He was young. He was good looking. He was horny. He was deployed. You know, whatever. You know, but I didn't give him a chance. You know, to really work it out. Even though we would try for years. After that, we would go back and forth. And his addiction, you know, he was an alcoholic, like I said, and then his alcoholism really took off after I left. And I actually came in through Alcoholics Anonymous through the back door. I called my dad, and, you know, trying to control everything and control everyone, I just thought that if I could control this alcoholic in my life, then I'll be happy. you know, if he'll quit drinking. And after he got out of the military, he just went through one job after another. And back then, you know, if you didn't have money for a good lawyer, you're not going to get any child support. He can just say, well, too bad, so sad, you know. So it was a difficult situation. So I thought, well, if I can sober him up, if he can stay sober, then he can, you know, keep a job, pay child support, and then I'll be happy. It was always, I lived my life, and then I'll be happy. You know, I was always looking into the future, and just like I was in a survivalistic mode all the time. So I called my father, who had gotten sober in Alcoholics Anonymous when I was 13, and had come to stay with me on the military base when I was 20, and we got this relationship going that I didn't get to have when I was growing up because he was in his alcoholism, and also my mother just kind of sheltered me, you know, I was afraid, you know, of rejection, you know, just all these things, you know, kids that are separated from their parents for whatever reason. And when he came and he stayed with me out on the base before I was going through all my divorce and stuff, he shared with me the miracle of his recovery, and he shared his story with me, and part of coming out and staying with me was part of his ninth step, but I wouldn't find that out until years later. Till I went through that myself. So I called him, and, you know, after having a few drinks, because I used to love doing the drinking dial, right? I don't talk to anybody about what's in my head, but if I have a few drinks, I can get on the telephone and I can finally share what's going on in my life, things that cause me pain. And so I'm doing the drinking dial, and I call my father, and, oh, woe is me, you know. Oh, if you had a husband like me, you'd drink too, you know, just the whole, you know, the pity party that I used to go through. And he said, you know, and he didn't judge my drinking or whatever. He said, you should probably go to this place called Al-Anon. And if you go to Al-Anon, you know, they might be able to give you some help on, you know, what you can do with your husband, because we still weren't divorced at that time. And so I started going to Al-Anon meetings. Gosh, I even think I went there after a few cocktails one time. And they very gently told me that I needed to go to Alcoholics Anonymous so I could find out more about this alcoholic, you know, that I couldn't stop complaining about. Oh, I would just go on, and, you know, my life would be happy if I could just fix him. Well, I started going to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, and I had this feeling that I was in the right place. And this is even years before I started going regularly. And I thought, okay, well, you know, I can get clean and sober. And if I get clean and if I get sober, then I'll get him sober too. So then I got on the sobriety bandwagon, and now I'm going to round up all the drunks that I know in my life, and they need to do this too, you know. I'm going to put everybody on the alcoholic bus, and everybody's going to go and you know, see the light. And alcoholics are very resistant to that, you know, and I couldn't understand why. Why everybody didn't see, you know, that it was so much better. And they kept talking about God, and that really irritated me because I grew up in the church, and, you know, and I had this great relationship with God as a child. But when I got older and different things happened in my life, I looked at God like, you know, this Santa Claus, you know, sitting up on a fluffy cloud that gave me coal in my stocking instead of the cool toys that I wanted, right? Yeah. You know, so I was pretty pissed off at my idea of God at the time. And I didn't want to hear anything about it. And people would be like, blah, 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 you know, you need to pray, blah, blah, blah. That's all I hear, you know, is yak, 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 blah, blah, blah. That's because I had more research to do. I had more drinking to do before I got really, really miserable, like miserable enough to actually listen to what they had to say. Because I thought that you couldn't, that an alcoholic wasn't somebody that looked like me. I thought an alcoholic was somebody, you know, wearing a trench coat, shivering in a doorway with a brown paper bag downtown. I thought an alcoholic was somebody passed out in their own vomit on the sidewalk. I didn't know that, you know, an alcoholic, you know, looked like me. And so I worked really hard to be an overachiever. You know, I worked full time. I was putting myself through college. Look at me, look at me, look how much I can achieve. Come in my house and see my beautiful furniture. I'm not an alcoholic, obviously, right? Alcoholics don't look like me. But I drank in solitude. you know, in the prison that I made, and that was in my own living room. Only I didn't know it until I was really, really desperate. So around the age of 27, 28, I'm getting really, really tired, you know, and Monday morning is really, really difficult, you know. My hangovers are so bad. I've got, you know, I've got my Lanta in my glove box of my car. I've got my Lanta at work. I also have my a flask in my desk at work. And my Lanta, you know, because my stomach is doing somersaults all the time. Usually, you know, I brush my teeth and I'm throwing up. You know, I'm just trying to, you know, keep my breakfast down so I can get my kids to childcare and I can make it through the day. And I would think, oh, you know, I just got to stay sober through my work day, you know. I didn't know I was, like, detoxing all day. I was so scatterbrained. If I wouldn't have been in a government job and had a good union and all that job protection, they probably would have kicked my ass out of there a long time ago, you know, because I never had any sick leave, never had any sick leave. I mean, I used up every single minute of my sick leave all the time. I was just probably a nightmare employee, you know. So I joined Alcoholics Anonymous. I went back, you know, because I heard a couple of things that they said that I thought that might be able to apply to me, you know, might be able to help me. And I stayed for a little while, and then I felt all well and wonderful, and I left, you know, because...
Let me ask you this, Jay.
Yeah, go ahead.
Jay, let me ask you this. Now, my experience and is usually that there has to be a bottom to go in. It sounded like... You're going in more on like an intellectual basis that this is
right.
This is an answer somewhere. You know, you haven't really hit your bottom yet. Is that a correct assessment?
Correct. Yeah, because I would go in there and I would look for the differences instead of the similarities. I would think, well, I've never been in jail. You know,
right.
I've never done this and I've never done that. So I wasn't desperate enough. I just didn't know it. I had the yets. So when I finally did get sober and I stuck, I thought that I had reached my emotional bottom, right? And I stayed sober for 5 years. I sponsored a lot of other women. I was very active in the program, very active in my home group. And I had, even during that time, I'd even gone into the military myself to pay off some student loans, you know, do my duties in my country. I graduated college. I'd started graduate school. You know, all these wonderful things that you can do when you're sober, because I'm my own worst enemy, and I'm the person that blocks my pathway to all my dreams. It's me, you know. And everything's going really great, and I was doing some lifting, and I hurt something between my fourth and fifth lumbar region in my lower back, and I pulled something, and you know, I went to the doctor, and I had this fabulous doctor that never asked me if, you know, any kind of history really. I don't remember much except this magical word, Vicodin. And I had heard of a friend that took some Vicodin for her pain, and it made it all go away. And I said, sure, you know, I'll try that. Well, the problem was is that once I started taking the Vicodin, I started doctor shopping because I would run out very quickly because I took too much of it. What happens with me is I have a high tolerance to things. I have a high tolerance to alcohol. I have a high tolerance to opiates. And I always need more of something. My brain, if it likes it, it always needs more. And so pretty soon I was working for doctors. Back then, before 9/11, you could just order it off the internet. If you have a credit card, order Vicodin from Guam, you know. And then my doctor, because I was complaining about not having enough medication, pretty soon I was on fentanyl diuretic patches. It's like a synthetic morphine, and I was taking 750 Vicodins for breakthrough pain. And I'm going to meetings still. And I'm practically drooling on myself. It's ridiculous. Oh, here's the recovery queen, practically drooling on herself, giving her sponsee a chip. I mean, it was ridiculous. You know, but when you're in the midst of your addiction, like, you can't see. And the turning point for me was I was still in my uniform. I left work and I was picking up my kids, and my oldest son, mom, because I was like nodding out while I'm driving the family van, you know, because I'm drooling on myself. I was so frightened. I took a 4-day weekend and I kicked that addiction. I went back in the rooms. I raised my hand and I said, I have one day. And I told my story about, you know, I wasn't sober because I was taking all this medication. You can't be sober and take that crap. You know, that's just my opinion.
That takes a lot of courage. Wow. That's great.
So, I had stuff happen in my life and da-da-da. And well, my daughter was almost abducted molested, and we went through this long protracted court trial, and I remember my sponsor telling me I had like another year of sobriety, and she told me, well, just pray about it, you know.
No.
just pray about it, you know. Oh God, you know, I was just like sitting there in court every day through clenched teeth thinking of 101 ways I want to kill this person. I want to kill him. That's all I think about is killing. I'm homicidal all the time. All I can think about is killing this man that's facing 23 years to life and that has completely altered my family and turned my family upside down, everything. Oh, that's all I think about is murder. Now, that's not really good for somebody that's trying to stay clean and sober to think about murdering another human being, and that's pretty much what they think about in their waking hours.
No, that is not a good way to try to get sober. Actually, the way to do it is you murder him, and then you repent, and then you go, no. Pray about it. What did he do now? He molested your child.
Yes, and it completely changed everything. It completely changed everything. And
how old was your daughter?
She was 5 at the time, and she was going to parochial school. And it's right before they go back to school. And right before they go back to school, so they're all sharing, you know, how I spent my summer. They get to my daughter, and what did you do this summer? She raises her hand, and she said, a stranger came over the backyard fence and licked my vagina. Oh, my gosh. So the principal, the pastor, they call me at work. They're like, oh, my God, why didn't you share this with us? We would have, you know, prayed for your family and prayed for you. I didn't want to share it with anybody. I was horrified.
I was horrified.
I could barely function. I could barely get up in the morning. I could barely go to work. I could barely just not taking a drink or putting something in me to change the way that I felt was just, it was so difficult because I wasn't sharing. And this is a theme that continues through my time in Alcoholics Anonymous, because I'm full of false pride and I can't reach out to other people when I truly and desperately need help. And what ended up happening was after the trial was over and he was able to plea bargain and he got 8 years.
I walked out of the courtroom
and I looked at the lawyer and he said, I'm so sorry. He said, I have 3 daughters myself. And I said, I don't know how you live with yourself. I don't know how you sleep at night, you know. But he works for the DA, you know. It's kind of like, lawyers have to work in that sewer for a while. It's kind of like being a doctor that has to work in the ER and so in the hood, you know, for a while before they get to have private practice, right? But anyway, so my solution was to go drink, and I just drove. It was pretty uneventful. I made sure that my daughter was at my mother, and I stopped at the liquor store on the way home, and I bought a big bottle of vodka, and I drank it, and I passed out, and I got up in the morning, and I went to work, and I act like nothing happened, you know, and I kept going to meetings like nothing happened, and I'm just getting crazier, like crazier. And so, I had to get sober again. I had to go back and get sober again. But you know what? This is where the story gets really fuzzy. It gets really, really fuzzy because it's getting really hard for me to stay sober. And by the time that my daughter's 7, I'm bouncing in and out of the program. I'm drinking and I'm going to meetings. I'm bouncing in and out of the program. And my life is just getting worse and worse and progressively worse. And even though I'm making money, I'm supporting us and everything, my life is unraveling. It's falling apart because I want to stay sober and I can't. The physical craving is so strong. The psychological craving for relief from myself is so strong. I don't even know how to fight it anymore. I can't. And I don't know what happened, but it was like 8 years it just went away. It's like in a big fog where I was just on a survivalistic level, and eventually when my daughter's 8, my mother takes her away. And it had happened after I lost my job. They towed away my Audi A4 Quattro, you know. I'm losing everything. And a social worker tells my mother that it's probably best if she takes her because they haven't seen me sober in quite some time. And so when I lose my daughter, I'm thinking, well, why stay sober now? My sons are angry. They won't talk to me, you know.
Yeah.
And I'm sitting there on my porch one day, and I'm drinking and I'm smoking like a chimney, and I'm counting up all the things that you did wrong, you know, all the things that you did to hurt me, and cursing God and why me, and the thought occurs to me that you know, maybe I should just drink myself to death. Maybe that would be a good idea.
Let me ask you this, Jay. Let me ask you this. Before we
get too long.
You know, I like to interject that one point. Pogo the alligator. We've met the enemy, and he is us. Did you work the steps that you had a sponsor? The sponsor was telling you to pray. So evidently, the sponsor just could only give you what she had, which didn't sound like much, but she gave you what she had. Were you working the 12 steps at the time? Had you accomplished that, or were you dicing around at it? What did the steps look like with the sponsor? Did you do any of the work?
I was going through sponsors like paper towels because they would tell me to do things I wasn't willing to do. I wasn't willing to get into acceptance, and every time I would sober up for any period of time, I just felt so angry. I felt like breaking things, and I wasn't willing. I wanted sobriety, but I didn't want to work for it.
Yeah, I didn't want recovery.
Right. And okay. I had had it before, and I knew what that felt like, and I think that's the only thing that made me keep trying. Because I knew how life could be, and how bad it could be, and so when my child was taken, the job market was falling apart. I was putting out hundreds of resumes, and I had, you know, in spite of myself, still had good references, and I was trying to get a job, and nothing was happening. But that's what was happening all over the country. I mean, in 2007, the economy was unraveling. And by 2008, I was getting pretty desperate. So one day I was looking through Craigslist, looking through jobs again, you know, and I was going to sell, like, something else that I had. I think I was selling my washer and dryer. I was just, like, down to the nubs, you know, trying to pay my rent, just trying to, you know, get another
survive.
Boss. I could make it through another day, you know. It was crazy. And my friends would come pick me up and take me to meetings. I'd be drunk, you know, just sitting there. I don't know. I don't even know why I was there. I was just, I don't know. I was just surviving. So I'm looking through.
You didn't know. Actually, I know why you were there. I know why you were there. You didn't know where else to go.
Yeah, I didn't know where else to go. You're right. Yeah, I didn't know where else to go. And that was the one place where I was safe and I wasn't drinking for an hour. You know, or two. Because a lot of times my sober friends would drag me to potlucks, make me go to speaker meetings, you know, drag me all around with them and make me stay sober for, like, a day. Or trick me into staying overnight at their houses so they'd make me dry out for a few days. You know, if they... It's you know,
the
it's a real
alcoholic.
Bitch.
Yeah,
you know, it's a bitch
alcoholic.
When people love
yeah.
you. When you spend any time in recovery and people love you and you make friends and you love them and they love you, it's a real bitch when you're trying to destroy your life because they won't let you.
Right.
My friends in the program would not let me. They wouldn't let me. And that was a good thing because, you know, I got sober again and I was able to get sober. I was able to sober up long enough to, like, start a business for myself. I was looking at Craigslist one day and I was seeing... There are all these massage therapists that are advertising on Craigslist. They charge $80 an hour. that's more than I'm going to make at any of these other jobs, right? I thought that was pretty fantastic. So I start going to massage school and, you know, put the cart before the horse. I set up shop, you know, because I needed to make money desperately. And I probably didn't do legitimate massages more than a few weeks, you know, before the first massage, you know, customer asked me, hey, you know, there's this body part that I need trouble with, you know, that I have trouble with, you know, maybe you could help me out. And, you know, and he suggested to me, he said, you know what, you can charge double if you just, you know, offer a little, you know, happy ending at the end, you know. And I quickly saw the beauty of that. It was like the first day that I advertised for FBSM, which is full body sensual massage. I was able to charge $120 an hour. And I saw 12 men that first day. And nobody tried to rape me. And everybody was actually, I think, just as scared as I was. The first client that I had was a married Middle Eastern guy that shook like a wet chihuahua for like the first half hour. He was so scared because I was so professional and my place was so nice and everything was so clean. And I didn't have any tattoos and I didn't look like I was strung out or whatever. He was surprised. I guess maybe some of the Craigslist girls look different than me, but, you know, he thought I was a cop, you know, because my whole operation there was so clean. And I was able to pay all my bills in one day.
And so this is an entrepreneur's dream. I've had businesses before, not quite like that, but I've had businesses where I went out and I made a ton of dough the first day out on the block, and I go, baby, I'm home. All I'm going to do now is repeat the process.
Yes, and over and over and over again. And I would work from, you know, sundown to, you know, from sunup to sundown, day in and day out. And I quickly learned, too, that in order to stay safe, that it's a good idea to work with other people. So I went back on Craigslist and I found other girls that were advertising the same thing. And before they shut all that down, I was able to put an ad in there. How would you like to work in a clean and professional environment? Blah, 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 blah. You know, because they had massage collectives in San Francisco. They didn't have anything like this in Sacramento, where everybody just chips in on overhead costs and they keep each other safe. And so what I did is I leased a house from one of my massage clients. He had a house that was getting ready to go into foreclosure. And I said, we can help each other. I'll save your house from going into foreclosure. I'll even remodel some things. It'll look really nice. And he's like, yeah, great, wonderful. You know, so this business was born. And one of those clients also told me about MyRedBook.com. MyRedBook.com is it's a pretty small part of the whole sex industry. It was based out of San Francisco. It's a site where escorts and FBSM providers advertise. And so anyway, I leased this house, and I'd never in my life made like $20,000 a month before. Never in my life. And so I thought, well, this is a fantastic thing. You know, I'll just run it like I ran my my mortgage business, because I used to have a side mortgage business. I'll just run it like that. There were all these variables and all these things I had no idea about because I was completely green. I was completely naive. I had no street smarts. I had no street background. I'd never, you know, known about the dark underworld of the adult business. And the predators were everywhere. When you're new and before you have any reviews on these review escort sites, the predators come out of the woodwork because they've been blacklisted by everybody else. So that first year is like boot camp for sex workers. It's incredibly frightening. And you either learn to navigate the labyrinth of human sexual behavior very quickly and human behavior, or, you know, one of two things happen. You either learn how to make the business really good for yourself and attract the kind of people that you want to see, or you become like a crackhead. Like, there really doesn't seem to be, like, any gray area. And the whole business is just full of drugs, you know, just full of drugs and alcohol. So, you know, while I'm doing this, I'm struggling to stay sober, and I can't bring myself to tell my sponsor. I can't bring myself to tell my sponsor, you know, I'm You know, it's great. I'm able to pay for child court monitoring now, and I'm able to have a nice place to live, and I'm able to help my sons with their bills and all of these things. But I had to fight off a rapist today. You know, creepy people call me on my phone and say horrible things to me that chill me to the bone. I mean, there are some people that circle that world that are so horrible and so dark. It's truly frightening. I think by being in the business now for 5 years, I probably heard every kind of sexual proclivity there is to hear, you know. And I don't deal with those people. I'm like all flowers and sunshine. The niche that I occupy is a particular niche. I'm a massage-centered sex surrogate. So I'm in that part of the group that has, I have a background in psychology. And I work with particular types of people. I work with disabled people. I give the veterans discounts. I see the people that have missing limbs. I see the people I think the guys are all telling their friends in the cancer and the bereavement groups about me because they come to me. I'm an emotional provider. So a man that has a wife that they haven't had a sexual relationship for 6 years because she has dementia and he has to change her diapers and he hasn't felt a woman's touch for years. I help that man feel whole again. Or at least
I understand that, but how are you doing with your sobriety now? So what happens?
I'm staying sober. Yeah.
How long are you sober now?
Now I'm sober for a little over a year.
Okay.
So
now what was the, have you hit the bottom? Have you worked the steps? Did you get a sponsor?
Now I'm doing those things. And now I'm describing the way that my business is now. But it wasn't always like that. It was a struggle for the first 3 years. It was a struggle for the first 3 years or so. What I did was, in the meetings now I'm being recognized. And that caused a problem. That caused lots of problems. Because these are people that I've gone to meetings with for years. Our children have grown up together, and I'm being recognized. We were at a friend's wake one time, this was a few years ago, and a friend of mine in sobriety comes up to me, and he's like, "Hey, are you so-and-so on Redbook? So-and-so told me that you're really so-and-so on Redbook. Is it true?" And then he thought that he could launch into all these stories about his lonely penis. And we're at a wake. I mean, for goodness sake, I mean, it was just horrible to try and live between those two worlds. And friends that I had, women that had never said a harsh word to me, wouldn't speak to me anymore. And that was incredibly heartbreaking. And by this time, you know, I've already been busted. So there's a charge on my record, my otherwise clean record. I can't get out of the business. I'm trying to apply for civilian jobs. But as soon as they do a background check, they won't answer my calls anymore. And so,
you're kind of stuck in the business now?
Huh?
You know, I could see, Jay, where there, you know, some men are lonely and, you know, the disabled, and they haven't had the touch of another human being. And I see the positive aspect of it. But it would just seem to me that kind of business would be hard to stay sober for, you know. It just takes away a spirit. I know it probably we're from different worlds in that sense, but it would just seem really difficult to maintain a high quality. You know, the whole idea of the program, and you know this, is our sobriety is contingent upon the daily maintenance of a spiritual condition. And, of course, what maintains itself? Nothing of itself maintains itself. You're either growing spiritually or you're declining spiritually.
Right,
and if you're declining spiritually, your recovery and then eventually your sobriety becomes tentative. And it would seem to me it would be difficult to continue to grow spiritually being in a sexual surrogate position, no matter how well-intentioned or how well-intended that would be to help people. It would just seem like that would be too much of a conflict. You don't find that, or that's...
Well,
what's
it was. You have to work through that, or you have to work. If you depend on that world for your survival, you're either going to make it better for yourself and learn how to do that, or you'll die there. You will, and there are many sex workers that die in their addictions, just because of the way other people feel about them and the way they feel about themselves, because of the way that we stigmatize sex work, even though it's legal in so many parts of the world and even legal in parts of our own country, the way we make these people feel about themselves also contributes to that self-esteem issue. But what I did while I was there, because I was, for the longest time, I was asking God, you know, why am I here? Because I didn't know why I ended up there. You know, I can't get a job, and, you know, oh, God, you know, I have a master's degree in psychology, and I can't, you know, get a job at McDonald's now that I have this, you know, conviction, and I'm stuck here, and I was very, very angry. And, you know, I thought, why me? And then I realized that there was no clean and sober network in the sex community. There was no place where we could network, no place for us to go. And so I started talking to the site owner, and I said, I want to create this clean and sober community here so other clean and sober providers will have a place to network. They'll have a place to go and where we can support each other, because I was able to find a couple of other girls that were going to meetings. I recognized them, and they recognized me, and we bonded together, and we said, we have to do something, you know. And so now I've realized, you know, I realized why, you know, my purpose was there, because I started this clean and sober community, and I started it 3 years ago, and, you know, now we have, I think we have close to a little over 400 people, which is pretty cool.
Oh, that's
cool. Wonderful.
Anytime I hear, you know, there's a gay community, and there's different segments of community that stay sober, I'll go to Lambda. I'm not gay, but I think it's good to go, because we're people in recovery. We make no judgment
right. Call
on other people.
Right.
You know, it's really the P with that has to judge someone else. I think it's a low self-esteem issue, I like that Jesus said, I will judge whom I will judge. It's given to you to love all men. So I leave it up to him. All I do is I help the next suffer, and they have to work out their own salvation, however that looks like.
Mm-hmm.
So you have 400 people there. Now, what is it? Is it a it's a group? You have a group? Or?
It's a group. We have a group, and I go on every morning, and I share the morning meditations, and I copy that from Blue Eyed Kitty site. I don't know if you've ever heard of her site, but
no.
There's all different forums where they have narcotics recovery, and they have AA recovery. And then I copy and paste into things, those things every day, and I call it daily inspiration. And when I'm doing that every morning, I'm doing my own morning meditation, so it's also good for my recovery. That's my service. But, you know, and a lot of people have gotten sober. One gal that got sober, what I was seeing was that the gals that were maintaining long-term sobriety eventually left. They left this kind of work. And it had always been a goal of mine to leave, you know, but what was holding me back was this madam charge. Now, when I got the madam charge, it's really funny the way that happened. The girl that was busted, when we were raided, she was giving the detective the blowjob of his life. So her charges were dismissed. Mine were actually reduced down to just a misdemeanor madam charge, which I was able to do the terms of my probation, and it's now being expunged. And when that's expunged from my record, which is going to be in about 2 weeks from now, I'll be able to get my life back. At least I'll be able to go back, I think, to my more normal life. I've realized, you know, that in order for me to maintain long-term sobriety, I need to leave adult work. But I'll probably maintain my service in that particular clean and sober community, but I no longer want to have advertisement on an adult website or work in the adult industry anymore. That's just for me personally. But there's a lot of things that surround that make it difficult, you know, that cause me a lot of stress. I have a stalker, a really tenacious one, which is often one of the pitfalls of very emotional providers, because we share such intense emotions with other people. They feel very connected to us. And when they become too clingy and they become too high maintenance, and they become, you know, you're not loving me enough, you're not giving me enough of your time, and we have to basically scrape the barnacles off of the mothership, you know, and no more candy for you. you know, and you need to find someone else, and I can no longer be your provider. Sometimes, you know, stalkers develop that way, and that's what's happened to me, and I don't want that affecting my personal life and my family. And so I need to leave, and so I don't have that stress. Plus the daily stress of, even though I go to this beautiful spa, this beautiful place that I've created with waterfalls and, you know, there's moving pictures of oceans from around the world and beautiful soft music, and it's such a beautiful place, every day I fear arrest. And if I'm ever arrested again, because of course I have another collective and there's other clean and sober girls working or other girls that are struggling, that's another problem. You know, because my name is on the lease, I won't just get a misdemeanor, man, I'm charged this time. I'll go to prison. So
yeah.
to have that kind of stress all the time, I can't handle it anymore. You know, so what I've done is I've opened up to my sponsor and I share these things with her, and I don't hide it. I don't hold it inside anymore, because if I hold it inside and I don't share with another human being, I don't have a go-to person that I can share everything with, you know, then I will drink. It'll back up on me. I have to take out my emotional trash on a daily basis. I don't want to dump that on my husband. It's hard enough for him. It's emasculating enough, you know, to not be able to get a job in this economy, to have your union has no work. You get retrained, you go into, you know, a new profession, there's no work there either. You know, so he has a little business, you know, where he repairs computers and stuff like that. But the main amount of the money comes, you know, from my business. But once I'm able to leave, I'll be able to make a decent income, and, you know, we'll be able to make it. Go ahead.
Is your dad still living?
My father got a promotion in November of 2011. He got a promotion, and so he went home.
So he's
waiting for me. So, you know, I know that he wouldn't want me in a place, in any kind of place, where I was in danger. And I'm in danger all the time. The girls that, or the women, I should say, that are and men that are in this, that are in the sex industry, are in harm's way. Because even though I have many screening tools, and there's provider database networks where we can put in somebody's information, and they go through America, South America, Canada, and I can look for people. You know, people can buy phones now at Walmart that are completely untraceable, and you could have Jack the Ripper calling you, and you have no idea.
Right.
You know, and we also have a reference system. But sometimes references fall through. You know, he saw Susie Sucks a Lot last week. Susie Sucks a Lot has great reviews. So, you send Susie an email and say, hey, is this John guy okay? He says that he's an okay guy, you know, and is there anything about him that would cause you not to see him again? Oh, you know, she's feeling lazy that day, or maybe she's had 5 cocktails and she's 3 sheets to the wind. So she just answers your email back, yeah, he's fine. And then next thing you know, you have Jack the Ripper on your table, you know, and he's starting to act like a weirdo.
That's too much stress. I could tell you right
now.
It's
too much stress. I mean,
I don't think I could stay sober living under that cloud. It would be tough.
It's difficult enough for people that just, you know, work at the Stop and Shop to stay clean and sober, for Christ's sake, you know, than somebody that has these kind of risks in their daily line of work. So I'm leaving, you know, and I've told all the girls, because they continue to, like, to relapse and stuff. I just can't be around, and I can't be, I can't sponsor everybody. I mean, it's just crazy. On Friday, there was the girls buying pills, and just, you know, somebody's having a coke problem, and I'm just really, really done with it. I can't have that kind of stress in my life. I don't want to deal with it. So I told everybody, when the lease is up in November, you know, I'm moving on, and you guys will either get your own lease or not, but we'll all be friends and everything like that. But
and your mother bear instinct clicks in, and you become very protective of your little girl.
Yes, because, you know, she's already asking me, hey, Mom, I'd like to be a massage therapist when I grow up.
Yeah,
no
bad. Oh,
no.
Boy.
No.
There we go.
No, My children will never, ever know the sacrifices I've made for them. They'll never know. Never know. And I don't ever want them to know.
Right. We don't want them to know.
Yeah, because I did what I had to do. I've done that. You know, we live in a decent home. There's food on the table. The bills are paid. And I think that, you know, we'll be able to make it without that. Even if I had a strictly therapeutic practice and I get all of my people from the gym across the street and I have a lot of therapeutic clients, you know, just from that, I would make a decent living, you know, just doing regular sports and deep tissue massage because I charge $50 an hour. $50 an hour in this economy is a really damn good living.
Yeah, you
and
can
not
do
have
it.
To
yeah.
put up with all of the nonsense. I'm tired of the nonsense. So, you know, today,
well,
I mean, that's what I'm doing for my sobriety is I'm leaving the adult business.
So you've worked all your steps. You've done all your steps. Are you done? Did you do the 12?
I'm still on 9. So, but one day at a time. I want to finish and we'll work on IU because I had this, this recent revelation that my expungement's going to be finished in a couple of weeks and I really want to get busy and I want to get away from this environment where these girls are having all these drug problems and I'm done with the stress. So I got to get to work.
You know, I would tell you this, Jay, if you looked at the website, I've come to the conclusion that sometimes thorough can rob timely. I think it's real important to once you get the steps done, you don't have to make all your 9-step amends to go to 10, 11, and 12. Not at all. I mean, this is an ongoing process. I would suggest as quickly as you can, finish up the work, and then you're sponsoring other girls right now?
Not anymore. Not anymore. Because I had to cut them loose, and for my own sobriety. Not anymore.
Well, you know, I like the one immunity we have from alcohol is intensive work with another alcoholic. This activity works when other activities fail. So I applaud the fact. I think the work. I mean, it kept you in survival mode, and you did what you have to do. But it's sort of a magnet to a lifestyle that's not going to serve you well in the future. It's not going to serve
right.
your family well. It's not going to serve your children well, and it's not going to serve your spiritual growth at all. So I applaud the fact that you've realized that and that you're ready to move on to a bigger life.
Yeah, I think that, you know, I've learned whatever lessons I had to learn. I started a clean and sober community in a place where there was none, you know. So even if I decide to leave that and not be of service to that group anymore, you know, for whatever reasons, I'm going to stick with it, you know, until I can find, another moderator that can go in my place. It really was a... The way that I grew spiritually was I learned how to love people that nobody finds attractive. I mean, the people that probably the only person that ever hugged them was their mother, you know, and being of service to them every day. Because I also work with a group of men who their equipment doesn't work, you know, so that whole aspect of it wasn't even a part of my session, really. So.
All right, well, let's leave it on an up note.
Yeah. Oh, an up note. Ha ha. No pun intended. We wouldn't
well,
want the conversation
so
to go limp.
Yeah.
Like.
Well, we need to close down. So do you have any last thoughts, Harold?
Well, I just I find it a very interesting story, and I really like that you're improving your life and getting to the point where it's like baking a cake. If you throw all the ingredients in there and then put it in the oven, you're not going to have a cake because all the ingredients need to touch all the other ingredients.
Yeah.
That's what we try to do with our life in recovery. And so I see you taking steps so that all the parts of your life can touch all the other parts, and nothing's going to be toxic. And I really support that. That is great.
Thank you. Thank you for letting me be of service today.
Well, thank you. I'll tell you right now, Jay, that your story will impact someone.
That's
so thank
what I hope,
you for
because
coming
I know
on.
That I know there's a lot of girls that are suffering in silence and that are in this kind of work and feel very isolated, and I don't want them to know that they're not alone.
Now, AA and all the Sister 12 Steps are all about being inclusive, not exclusive. We're here to fight drugs and addiction, not each other. So we grow. Sometimes time takes time, and growth is the key. It's a journey and not a destination. So, you know, you're on your journey, and you're going to the right place. So that's as good as it gets. So thanks,
hey,
quite
a thing. The best place in the world is the last house on the block, right?
There you go.
Good night, fellas. Thank you again for letting me share.
You're welcome. Good night, Jay.
Good night.
In closing,
bye-bye.
I'd like to say, pardon me? In closing, I'd like to say, is that something? In closing, I'd like to say, RUM Radio's in 151 foreign countries, including Mississippi. We have 2,800 towns, cities, and villages. I haven't updated that lately. There's more than that. And over 300,000 hits to the website. So we're going around town. A lot of folks know we're around now, and we're doing a good work. No money is being made, and we're anonymous to the 11th tradition. The credit for this work goes to God and the fellowship. So if you need some sponsorship information and you want to get into the middle of this thing, RUM Radio will give you a hand. But remember, it's only good information until you take an action. Otherwise, it's just an avoid. Remember, the magic words in AA and all the sister fellowships is action and more action, for faith without works is dead. And remember, we'll see you on the radio, rumradio.org. Good night.
Good night.
Good night.